Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club in Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum, and you can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter with the hashtag InforumSF. Tonight's discussion is Water, Innovating the Essential Resource, and is sponsored by Levi Strauss & Company. I'm Jason Mark, editor of Earth Island Journal, and tonight I'm joined by Jake Norton, John Rose, Evan Thomas, and Peter Glick. Jake Norton is a professional mountain climber and co-founder of Challenge 21, which is planning to engage 2.1 million people with the water crisis and raise $2.1 million for sanitation and water projects around the world. He has bagged an incredible number of peaks, including Kilimanjaro and Mount Everest. John Rose is a professional surfer and founder of Wave for Water, a nonprofit organization aimed to bring clean water solutions to impoverished countries around the world. And he just returned from New York and New Jersey, where his organization is doing some disaster relief work after Hurricane Sandy. Evan Thomas is assistant professor and director of the Sweet Lab at Portland State University. He's also executive vice president of Mana Energy Limited. And prior to joining Portland State University, Evan worked as a civil engineer at NASA, where he was the principal investigator and project manager on concepts for sustainable moon and Mars spacecraft. And finally, we've got Peter Glick. He's a co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute and one of the world's leading experts on water and climate issues. Dr. Glick was named a MacArthur Fellow and is known for his 2007 paper on the human right to water, which means that he's technically a genius. So we've got, as opposed to a jock, which these guys are amazing, jock, gentlemen, renaissance men. We got 7 billion people on the planet going towards 9 billion people. Most of the planet, though, it's a good chunk of its water. Only 2.5% of its fresh water, and even that's, most of that's locked in ice and underground. And climate change is only going to make the stresses on that for industry, agriculture, and people even more pressing. And at the same time, even before we got to those numbers, millions of people around the world don't have access to clean water. And every year, millions of people, including many of them children, die from waterborne diseases. These four gentlemen have been working on those issues for a number of years, both exposing the problems and addressing the solutions, and I'm looking forward to hearing from them. So let's start with Peter Glick, and the view from 30,000 feet. I mean, what, you know, we hear about the water crisis, or some people even talk about peak water. So what are the challenges we're facing in 2012 with regards to fresh and clean water?
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm happy to be here. Commonwealth Club events are always very exciting. I have to say, getting ready for this in the green room back there, it was exhausting just to be with these guys, climbing mountains and surfing and doing the on-the-ground actual work to address water issues that they do. Water's a big issue. Water's connected to everything we all care about, as we all know. As we've seen with Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, the first thing that people lose and the thing that people care about the most is water. Electricity might go out. You can live in your dark apartment cave for a while, but without water, things go bad very quickly. And the reality worldwide is that there are almost 1 billion people worldwide that don't all the time have access to safe water, which we all take for granted, and 2.5 billion people, or 40% of the world's population, that don't have access to adequate sanitation, something that, again, except in extreme disaster situations, all of us take completely for granted. And that leads to bad things. It leads to water-related diseases, cholera, dysentery, guinea worm, schistosomiasis, the things that we in the developed, richer world got rid of 100 years ago when we started to build the sophisticated water systems that we have, but that are still prevalent throughout much of the developing world and are a serious problem. Climate change is going to affect water availability and water demand and extreme events like Hurricane Sandy. Conflict over water is a problem. We fight over water. There's a long history of conflict over water. So water and politics is a big issue that is unresolved. And as water becomes more scarce, as we reach peak water, limits on the available water, we're going to see more tensions over access to water. And we've seen that, for example, just in the last year in Kenya, where we've seen people dying over conflicts over access, in conflicts over access to water. Ecosystems and water, and if you live in California, this is something we're more familiar with. One of the big problems with water is that the ecosystems that depend on water, the same water that humans require, have suffered for over a century because of water withdrawals. The Bay Delta, which all of us in California are aware of, is a locus of problems over water because the ecosystems are collapsing because of the water that humans have taken out. So conflict, ecosystems, human uses of water, water and politics, water and economics, water touches on everything. And I know we're going to talk, I hope, particularly about solutions, but the water crisis is real, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. And unless we start to think about not just problems in distant places, but problems here where we live, we're not going to move to effective solutions. And maybe I'll just leave it there.
And to kind of put a little bit of a human face on this, so Jake, I mean, your work is really with Water for People is about, raising awareness of these issues. So when you're out talking to audiences, what are some of the stories you share with them about people you have seen who are water insecure in countries around the world?
Yeah, I mean, as Peter just so beautifully outlined, the water crisis is huge, and I think we all know that theoretically. It's an easy idea to conceptualize, but it becomes really intense when you start seeing it in practice around the world. And my travels around the world as a climber and now as an advocate for the work of Water for People and water and sanitation as a whole has really opened my eyes hugely to what's really going on. Take, for example, a place that's very near and dear to my heart, the country of Nepal. I've been there over 25 times in the last 20-some-odd years, and here you have a country that has probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, mountain watersheds in the world, incredible water-rich country, and yet you go into Kathmandu and you see these taps that were built several hundred years ago that now have run dry. They're no longer providing water. The springs have dried up because everything's being tapped out. The once mighty Bagmati River that feeds into the Ganges, the sacred river of India for over a billion Hindus, now is just a trickle of sewage and industrial effluvia for 6 months out of the year. Then it's flushed every monsoon if the monsoon's good, and then it goes right back to a little trickle of pretty much raw sewage. And then in turn you break it down and you start looking at the people who are depending on these watersheds all around the world and of course the environments that depend on them as well. It's all intertwined and it really opens your eyes to my eyes to what a big, pressing, very real issue it is. And not to deviate too much, but my wife Wendy, who works for Water for People, she and I were laughing cynically a little bit during the presidential debates, especially the one about national security, that not only didn't climate change come up, but the discussion of water. Water may not be a pressing issue if you don't live on the eastern seaboard right now for us on a daily basis, but it is a huge concern for us from a selfish national security perspective. These issues are all intertwined and affect all of us, and it's time we start addressing them.
And that's just the kind of the day-to-day challenge, again, of folks in Nepal or in sub-Saharan Africa or many places. John, I wonder if you could talk about also kind of what happens to folks when disaster strikes. So my understanding is that you started waves for water after the tsunami that really destroyed large parts of Indonesia, and then you've gone on to do disaster relief work. So I'm wondering what are some of the situations you've encountered, again, especially at least when it comes to water in places that have had an earthquake or have had a tsunami or have had some other natural disaster.
Well, yeah. Thanks for having me here. Really honored to be here, especially with these guys. I realized back there how smart you guys are. And I was very impressed and thankful to be part of it. So I think in terms of disasters, as you just stated, I was selfishly motivated. I wanted to go surfing. And I went to Indonesia, and I bought 10 water filters with my own money and went there, and this earthquake struck while I was there. And I had the intent to do well, but I was thrust into a unimaginable situation, and I got a crash course in not only disaster relief, but really how practical these solutions are, these solutions that exist, and they're readily available. And it doesn't mean they are the end-all, be-all solution, but they're there. And it sort of dawned on me, like, why should a five-year-old kid ever die again if this is available? So it became, for me, the biggest realization was like, okay, wait, this whole water crisis, Peter is the expert, you know, on all this stuff, but I agree with him that a lot has to happen, you know, before it can get better. But I also feel like this is a completely solvable problem in our lifetime. And so when it comes to these solutions, you know, you get to see how practical they are. You get to see how quickly they will change. I mean, we've distributed water filters into communities where the very next day I go back and check, you know, and a mother will walk up to me and say, my baby doesn't have diarrhea for the first time in his life. You know, and it's those types of things for me. I mean, water is essential, as Peter said. It is, in my belief, a fundamental right, just like air. You know, and to your point, Jake, you know, water is the new oil. We hear that a lot. You know, there's wars fought over water. But for me, it's a fundamental right. And I think when a disaster strikes, it is always about getting people back those fundamental basic needs that they need to rebuild from and make better choices, you know, thereafter. And so then for me, it's always in disasters, the needs are the same. It doesn't matter what class you are. It doesn't matter what country you're in. We work in Japan. And in Japan, you know, I was going around finding upper middle class families that were outside of their house around makeshift fire pits boiling water. And, you know, they needed what we were doing. Maybe it was a little bit different in the design of the program. It wasn't going to be as long term, but they still needed it. So I guess what I really realize out of disasters is just that, and we do developmental work as well, and you see it, but is that water is a fundamental need, and I think that we have more than enough solutions and technology available to activate. And this is not a question of technology, it's a question of access.
Evan, I'm curious, how did you get involved in work around clean water and sanitation?
I was an engineer at NASA for 6 years. We did water treatment systems for spacecraft. So today's coffee is also tomorrow's coffee and the next day for the guys on the space station. And those systems cost $100 million to treat water for 6 people. And that's worthwhile. That's worthwhile engineering, and it's worthwhile to further a space exploration mission. But it also struck me that, as Peter mentioned, there's still a billion people in the world that lack access to clean water every day, and they don't need a $100 million system to address it. And as John just mentioned, disasters help bring forward the water crisis, but it's there every day for many, many people. The UN says it's closer to 780 million people now, but in fact, it's pretty well accepted that that's a underreport and a big challenge, and this is something Water for People is very familiar with. A big challenge is not just getting technologies into communities, it's making sure that they're functional after a couple months or a couple years or after 10 years. Because water's continuous. Vaccines, you touch somebody once and they're good. Water treatment systems have to work their whole lives. We know, many of us know, that AIDS is a big problem in Africa, but it only kills 2% of the children under 5. Children under 5 deaths, it's 2%. And malaria is a big problem, and people talk about malaria and mosquito nets. That's only 7% of the children under 5 deaths. Obviously, big deals worth addressing, but diarrhea is 12% of children under 5. That's nearly a million children every year that die because of diarrhea. And a closely related problem, I know this is about water, but a closely related problem is pneumonia. It's 18%, and that's almost 2 million children a year. And that is often tied to indoor air pollution. 3 billion people cook with unsustainable biomass every day. So they use firewood, cook on indoor campfires, sometimes to treat their water, usually to cook. It exposes them to indoor air pollution and respiratory disease. They don't have enough wood or energy to go around to treat their water, so they end up drinking contaminated drinking water. And so we've got a deforestation, climate, and health and water problem all rolled into one for 1/6 of the whole world. So to answer your question, I was at NASA working on astronaut pee recycling and thought that this was maybe a little bit more useful.
I'm glad you found your life's calling. So John said that water's a fundamental right, and I'm guessing that all of you forward would agree. Peter, you wrote a paper on this. The idea that that water is a human right, and yet it's also a commodity. This is something that's bought and sold around the world. And so I'm wondering, this question is really for any of you. How do those, that aspiration of water being a human right and the reality of us living in a market-based system in which this human right is a commodity, how do those things conflict, and how do you try to get around them?
I'd be happy to talk about that. But before I do, just a quick observation. The microcosm that Evan's talking about with the space station and having to recycle water, the truth is we live in that microcosm. There's only a fixed amount of water on the planet, and the population is growing, and this question at the very beginning about peak water, we're running into limits. The astronauts have no choice. And we could boost water up to them at 8 pounds per gallon. I don't know what it costs to boost
a pound.
Okay, $30,000 to put a pound into orbit. You don't want to be bringing up water. And so they've developed a system that produces perfectly potable water from wastewater. And we have those systems Mother Nature is one of those systems. That's what the hydrologic cycle is. It turns any kind of water, salt water, back into fresh water. And that's the way we need to think about it. I mean, the spaceship Earth idea is not a new one, but it's a valid one. So a little digression. Sorry about that. There is a human right to water. It took the United Nations 25 years or more to debate that question. But in 2010, they passed a binding resolution declaring a human right to water. There is a human right to water at the same level as political rights, economic rights, social rights. The question now is, how do you balance that with water as an economic good? We all pay, most of us, I imagine, in this audience and listening, pay for water, probably not very much. Probably less than your cell phone bill and your cable TV bill and your electric bill and your all the other bills that you get. But we pay for water. And what we're paying for is the service of bringing clean, potable water to us and getting rid of wastewater. And we ought to pay for water. The human right to water doesn't disagree with that. The human right to water in part says, if for reasons of poverty you can't pay for water, you can't be denied water. It's the responsibility of governments and communities and individuals to find a way to meet basic human needs for water, independent of money. But when you want water services and you can afford to pay for them, you should pay for them. The corporate responsibility around water is a big debate. Levi Strauss has been a leader in this area, but figuring out how the role of corporations in water use and water stewardship is an interesting challenge today as well. And balancing that economic good and the human right good is part of the big debate around water today.
I would just add to that. I mean, when you look at successful development models, and again, I just want to clarify, I don't want to present myself as a development expert. I'm an advocate for development, but not an expert, but I can speak from a layman's perspective and knowing Water for People's work very well. They have an incredibly successful model, and it is because they treat water or any process of development as a commodity. It's not a charity. It's not just, you need water, here it is, we're all happy, let's walk away. It's everybody needs to invest, and when you look at Water for People's model, they're actually only providing a small bit of the financing for any given project, and then a lot of that financial means to make a project happen, and the skill and the manpower, everything to make it become a reality comes from everything from the village and the individual people all the way up to the municipality and the national government. And that's a critical component to successful development work. It has to be taken seriously, and everyone from the bottom to the top has to be invested or else when it breaks, it just, everybody walks away. It doesn't, and it is going to break. All development work is going to break at some point. Every pump is going to break, and there has to be people who feel invested in it. So I think, you know, whether, if somebody can't pay for it monetarily, maybe they're too poor to actually pay for it, they go and they help dig, do the work and pour the concrete and put in the pieces to make it work. But everyone has to be invested for that to be a long-term sustainable thing. So that does bring it into the commodity realm and make it actually an economic incentive.
And Evan, I'm curious, I mean, you're actually working in one of the programs that you've been involved in, LifeStraw, is working sort of at the commodity level by selling carbon credits on the EU market for doing water sanitation work in Kenya, right?
That's right. About 5 years ago, my company came up with the idea of earning carbon credits for the treatment of drinking water. As we mentioned, many, many people don't have access to clean water. They don't treat their water. That's where the health issue comes from. But in many communities, if you do treat your water, one of the ways you might do it is to boil it with wood that might not be renewable. The wood's being extracted faster than it's growing in many of these countries. So we wanted to link some of these challenges that we've identified here, the sustainability, long-term sustainability of water treatment interventions. And there's a lot of ways to do that. Do it microcredit, microfinance, little mini utilities, or shared pay-for-performance out of grants. So it could still be grant-based, but it's pay for performance on the back end. Our idea was carbon credits. And the challenge is that the carbon markets are designed to reduce emissions and promote clean development internationally. It's a $120 billion a year market, and it's supposed to include everyone. It doesn't include us by choice, but it's 70% of the market's in China, and because they're building coal-fired power plants at the rate of one a week. And 20% of it's in India. And less than 2% of it is in the entire continent of Africa. Less than 2% of carbon projects are in Africa. And the reason is there just is not significant energy use to speak of. A lot of people are using energy. They don't have enough energy to meet their demand, and they're doing it on a household level. So we married those ideas, those issues, and came up with a concept where we earn carbon credits based on reducing the demand for people to use energy to treat their drinking water. And as a result, we did a 4.2 million person program in Kenya last year. We distributed 900,000 life straws on a household scale to the entire western province of Kenya. We're doing another program now that's both cook stoves and water filters for 600,000 households in Rwanda. It's targeting the poorest 30% of the country. And we finance all the money's paid up front. In one case in Kenya by Vestergaard Franson, they put $40 million into it. In Rwanda, a company called Del Agua is putting $50 million into it. This is capital. This is capital investment. And we recover those costs if and when we actually prove that our water filters are being used. Not that we put them out there, but that they're being used, that water's being treated, and that we've realized health benefits. Only then do we get our carbon credits and are able to pay ourselves back. So it's not the only way, but it's one way that we've combined the climate issues with energy issues, with water, and finally what you guys were just touching on, which is accountability and sustainability in water projects. And I will say our method is controversial. We have critics out there that don't like that we earn carbon credits based on hypothetical energy use. And I'd be happy to talk about that issue if you want.
Well, let's give John a second to jump in here. So I'm wondering if in your work, especially around the disaster relief work and access to water, have you ever run into, again, perhaps tensions around sort of water as a commodity, especially in a dire situation with water as a human right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you're dealing with the basic idea of privatization, you know, and that stuff you see with any commodity. And you're dealing, it's power. You know, water, we believe it's a fundamental right, but it's power. And so you're always going to be dealing with those people in those communities who are going to try and exploit that power. For me, I've seen it's on this point, but I've seen it's also one of the main things I've seen that I've learned that I'm just so amazed by, and I'm sure you guys have seen this too, is, you know, water gives you life. It gives you so many things, but I've watched it absolutely change the socioeconomics of a community, like in this village in Indonesia, for example. You know, and these are things that I don't know. I mean, I didn't know until I saw it. But like, I watched, you know, these women were walking, you know, 4 miles every day, each way to basically a cesspool. And then, coming back and spending half their day doing that. And then spending the other half their day gathering firewood to boil that water. All of these are bad on multiple levels, you know, from deforestation and everything. But you're sitting there just going, these people are absolutely underwater. And then there's people taking advantage of it. Because there is a municipal water source if they don't want to walk. That in this case, they had to pay $10 or whatever it was. Yeah, $10 a month, which they don't have at all. And the water came in an old kerosene truck. Literally, it was contaminated water that they were selling to these people. And these are just baffling things. So when we're able to come in and give some sort of solution and help correct those imbalances a little bit, you watch, okay, they still have to walk. They still have half their day that they are, you know, giving up to just go get this water. But if you give them a chance so they don't have to spend the other half of their day getting firewood, they now have that half the day to work on their crafts, which then they can sell, which then completely alters the course of their future and their life. And that's something that I think I went off subject a little bit there, but that for me was something in combination with the commodity aspect and privatization is just so encouraging to me to see that there's an incredible ripple effect with this stuff.
So speaking of ripple effect, I think we've got the idea pretty clearly. There's clearly a water crisis on the planet, more acute in some regions than in others. But as Peter said, you know, we're on a closed loop here, and we've got to use the water that we've got here on Spaceship Earth, if you want to use that term. So Evan shared with us at length how LifeStraw works. I'd love to hear from the rest of you guys. What are some of the technologies, whether operating at very large scales or household technologies, that seem to you the most exciting, the most promising for addressing some of these issues?
Who's that addressed to?
Anybody.
Well, let me frame it a little differently. The solutions to our water problems, I think, I would argue, aren't just technology. I think they're smart institutions. I think it involves the proper use of economics and pricing and markets in certain ways. It's smart regulation. The people who say no regulation, I think, are missing the boat. It's a combination of all of those things. There are lots of solutions out there, and some of them are technological, but not all of them. And understanding the nature of the problem helps you then rethink the nature of the kinds of solutions that are available to us. And, you know, you've heard little hints about all of these things, but the example about young women especially having to walk miles to get bad water is a good example of sort of the integrated socioeconomic factors with this problem. The poor are willing to pay for water. They often pay in lost opportunity, especially for young women. And when you bring safe water to a village and young women no longer have to walk miles, spend half their day collecting water, they get to go to school. They get to participate in the economic life of their village. They get to produce income. Educated women have smaller families. That affects the population issue. These things are all connected in ways that we don't completely understand, but ultimately have huge impacts on us. So get the right technology, but also get the right institutions and the right community groups together and the right pricing for water. And then all of a sudden the solutions no longer seem daunting, but they actually seem achievable.
I think similarly to what Peter was saying, it is, yeah, so much about the right technology, and sometimes that technology may not be technology. It may just, you know, you have to go in and talk at the source. You know, what works here, I mean, this seems obvious, but it's amazing how often it's not followed. What works here in the U.S. isn't necessarily going to work in Rwanda or Uganda, or it may only work for a week, then it's broken, and everyone says, wow, that, you know, that really cool technology costs $12,000 for a replacement part, that's not going to function very well. So sometimes there's a much simpler, locally based solution. There's a guy I read an article about in northern India who, his village area, he's an engineer, went to school, but came back to his village. They were having irrigation problems as rivers were becoming more erratic. There was more population base, not enough water, and glaciers were receding. So he figured out how to build his own glaciers. And so in the wintertime, he stops water and he traps it in these rock retaining walls and basically creates his own artificial glaciers. And then in the summertime, when demand is high, people can pull the water out of those artificial glaciers and irrigate their fields and not be pulling well water, and it meets a lot of needs. So again, a very rudimentary solution to what could have otherwise been a complex technological problem. And the right technology is probably the best innovation in all spheres.
Well, I agree too that it's not just technological solutions. So much is education too, and retraining sometimes, because in some cases, for example, a project we did that was a rainwater catchment project for it was actually a domestic project here with the Lakota Indians in South Dakota on our Pine Ridge Reservation. They've been so, for generations before them, they caught rainwater. That's in their DNA, living off the land. So you're bringing a solution, but they need to be retaught it. And it's not necessarily you're bringing in some technology. You're bringing in this thought process and this concept that is actually embedded in their DNA. And so that's just an educational thing and a reminder of like, hey, these are a few things we can do to capture this water. And you start to see that transformation in them, and you start to see that stuff reawaken. And then they have access to water. So I think a lot of it for me is that, well, it's a two-part thing. I believe so much in the technology that's out there because I've seen the impact that it has. It's amazing to me. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a scientist. Leave that to the really smart guys over here. But I just think that's a two-part, I mean, it's always about education and technology, but I've seen that.
And I am an engineer. We're willing to geek out. I'm happy to geek out about ultrafiltration membranes and distillation and reverse osmosis and UV, but it's really not about the technology. At NASA, we call the proximate and ultimate causes of failure. So a proximate cause of failure of a soil or water system that you guys use might be that it got clogged or somebody didn't backwash it, but the ultimate cause is a lot more complex. The proximate cause when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up was an O-ring. That's not the reason it blew up. It was a whole systematic study of NASA and the culture and the people and the financing and the accountability. And it's the same reason water systems fail in developing countries. It's not because the valve wasn't designed well, maybe sometimes, but it has much more to do with education, empowerment, accountability, at every level, not just a village level, not just a district level, not just a national government level, but at every level. And so it is really not about the technology, but one technology that is cool and is interacting with those levels of a social structure and an economic structure is the prevalence of mobile technology now. Rwanda is 98% cell phone coverage. Kenya is 93%. Indonesia is 85% cell phone coverage. We work in villages where people have dirt floors and they have one chicken and they have our water filter and cook stove are the only things in their house besides their cell phone. And this is doing wonders for accountability, for democratization of water and energy and a lot of other agriculture. And it also gives us an opportunity to learn a lot more about what's working and what isn't in the field. One thing that we also do is sensors. We actually install sensors on some of our cook stoves and water filters, and we work with Water for People. We have sensors on your water pumps, and we have them on Cascade Designs electric chlorinators. You also work with CDI. All over the world in 12 countries now, using in remote villages that if you haven't traveled to developing countries, you'd feel pretty out of place in these areas, that have cell phone coverage, full bars. And they rely. Our sensors relay data back.
They don't have AT&T, I guess.
they relay data back to us, back to everyone, back to local communities, all the way to us in Portland, where we study what projects are working and when they're and what aren't, and when and why.
Can I follow up on that?
Yeah, please.
I think there are now more cell phones than there are toilets worldwide, which is a bizarre thing to think about. But there are really, and this is actually a very exciting thing, there are some really innovative things going on with technology, with this aspect of technology in the water world. At the Pacific Institute, we're working on a project, a couple of projects in this area. One, using not smartphones, but regular cell phones in Indonesia, where they're very prevalent, a project designing SMS systems, messaging, text messaging systems with local communities, so when there's a problem in their community, a water problem in their community, they can send a text message to the local water agency saying, look, there's a problem with quality or access or this tap isn't working, but also to the local community group, so that the community group can start to apply pressure saying, look, these are the water services we want and we're not getting them and there's a real-time problem, and I think it has the potential to dramatically change the ability of communities to play an effective role in their water management. Another little example, again, at the Institute, we've developed a smartphone app at the moment only for Android, but we're looking for an iPhone developer if there's somebody out there working for free, to map public drinking water fountains. We've done some work about bottled water. This gets back to privatization and this question about commercializing water. One of the reasons bottled water has exploded is it's harder and harder to find public water. I know where I work, I can find more easily a commercial place selling bottled water than I can find a public drinking water fountain. But we have this app to map public drinking water fountains. You can either call up a map and it tells you where the nearest one is, or you can call up a map and add to an open database system a water fountain that's not in the map. It's just an example of information technology, access to cheap technology that gives communities more power. It's not water purification. It's not water delivery. But it's information. And in many ways, that's part of the problem, too.
As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting Water, Innovating for the Essential Resource with Jake Norton, co-founder of Challenge 21, John Rose, founder of Waves for Water, Evan Thomas, director of the Sweet Lab at Portland State University, and Peter Glick, co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute. I'm Jason Mark, editor of Earth Island Journal. Evan, you said you didn't want to geek out, but I'm wondering if we could just geek out a second on drinking our own urine, which is always a great topic of conversation. Really seriously, a lot of this conversation is about sanitation, but it also gets back to supply. Is how do we find ways to use less water? And I'm wondering how we translate those technologies really to scale. And then also, I would love to hear anybody talk about some of the challenges that, you know, we've confronted either with governments or regulatory agencies, or also just the popular kind of ick factor of water recycling and gray water and black water use.
One of the things about the energy crisis or climate change, which are connected, is that it really affects everybody. So the United States is the biggest single emitter historically and currently, and that impacts the whole world. The water crisis is a little different. It's definitely a crisis, but it has national scope, it has regional impacts, but our issues in California are not the same as the issues in Rwanda. And the technologies and the methods and the financing and the tools aren't necessarily the same. And it's not the same on the space station. On the space station, we have to remove the salts out of urine. And we actually have to add minerals to the water afterwards because it's too clean. It's so clean it's unhealthy to drink without additives. In Rwanda, in Kenya, Uganda, and most of East Africa, a lot of Central America, a lot of Southeast Asia, the issue is surface water contamination. It's sometimes groundwater contamination like arsenic in Bangladesh and Nepal, but mostly it's surface water contamination. And it's not salts or heavy metals or pharmaceuticals, which is stuff we struggle with here. It's bacteria. It's decomposing plant and animal matter and manure and human waste. And it's mostly the human waste that can lead to the biggest health issues for communities. And so the big four things you have to address are water quality, quantity, access, and sanitation. And so all of those are technical questions, logistical questions, but they all interact with each other. And the challenge is, as I mentioned, similar to vaccines, you kind of have to do all of them to even be able to see the impact. So this is a multifaceted problem. It's why there are so many organizations working on different pieces of it and together at every level.
So I've drunk the water from NASA's purification system.
And?
And I'll tell you why. Because I know from my experience that the technology to purify water to any standard is something that's not new technology. It's something we fully understand. Many Americans and many people worldwide are already drinking recycled water. If you live downstream of an upstream city, the water in the river that you're taking out has been purified by the upstream city before it went into the river, and then it's been purified again by your city before it was put into your system. Now, if you live in San Francisco or in the East Bay like I do, you're lucky because the water comes directly from the mountains and it's not used beforehand. But Mother Nature naturally recycles water. The filters that you describe, reverse osmosis or ultraviolet purification, those are imitations of nature. Ultraviolet purification is imitations of the purification power of the sun. Reverse osmosis filtration is imitations of the filtration capacity of the soils, the bacterial systems. This is all nature. So the ability to produce incredibly pure water from any quality of bad water is something that we have. And the ick factor is an education problem. It's a understanding of what's going on. It's a realization that water's limited and we have to think about recycling as a new source of water. We can't think about treated wastewater as a liability anymore. It's an asset.
I want to hear from Jake and John, but first we're going to be taking your questions in about 5 minutes. So if you do have a question for any of the panelists, please start lining up at the mic. So yeah, I'd love to hear from you guys on this question.
Well, yeah, I think for me it just goes back to education again. Because I'm sure you guys have seen this out in the field, and there's a misuse of the technologies and the solutions, obviously, if there's not that proper education. And that misperception of water that is dirty, it's visually dirty, ooh, that's going to make me sick. Well, obviously, all the things we know, all the things that make you sick or potentially fatal things, you can't see. You know, so there's these things like where I would see chlorine tabs when that was like the big solution for the NGOs, would distribute them with, and some were really great with their education and some weren't. And you'd see these villagers who would get river water and it's really dark in color and they'd be like, wow, it's really dirty. So they'd throw 3 tabs in and it's super bad for you. You know, that is like, very, very, it can be very harmful. And so it comes back for me to that education and making sure that if you are introducing or implementing these solutions into these communities, that they're implemented the right way. You know, and I think that comes down to development and your strategy and your program to make sure that you are maximizing your efforts and making sure that it's sustainable.
I'll just say quickly to add on points. I mean, that is all right on topic and right on focus. And I'd just add on that, you know, first it needs to be brought up more in the discussion of water. You know, I mean, that as we started it off with, nobody really wants to talk about what happens to the water after we use it. You know, it's not as sexy to talk about poop and pee. It's really cool to talk about water, but they go together. We can't have one without the other. So all of us and everyone out here, we have to start talking about sanitation. And I think just like water, sometimes monetizing that sanitation, Water for People has had great success with what they call sanitation as a business. You know, figuring out simple solutions, simple technologies that will allow people to take their waste and turn it into a commodity, something they can sell on the market. It encourages them to spend the money to buy the right toilet system to deal with that waste and then sell it, and they'll pay it off. It's a business for them. And so, you know, really thinking as cleverly about sanitation as we have about water is a huge part of that whole process.
So we've got a pretty long line of questioners, so let's jump right into it,
yeah.
Please.
Hi, I'm Jen Boynton. I work for a website called triplepundit.com. We cover news related to sustainability in business. And I was thinking as you all were talking about our farmland here in California, the nation's vegetable basket, right? And as far as I know, the cost for water for farmers isn't connected to the use. And I was wondering how you change that in a when it's so politically unpalatable to do anything that's going to raise the cost of food.
It's a great question.
So I wrote agriculture down in my notes thinking, all right, we haven't talked about that. Most of the water that humans consume goes to agriculture, to the irrigated farmland primarily that is so important for growing the food that we need. And California is a wonderful place to grow food, and a lot of our water goes there. Farmers pay less for water than we in the cities pay. Now, they don't get potable water typically for irrigation. It's a different quality of water, and that's important to understand. And you can't raise the price of water much before it begins to affect the price of food. But you can raise the price of water. Farmers don't pay enough for water, I believe. And when you raise the price of water, farmers use it more efficiently. Farmers are very smart. There's some really innovative things going on in agriculture around the world, but also in, especially in California, of farmers figuring out how to use water more effectively and more efficiently, grow more food with less water, return water for natural ecosystems. I'm sort of optimistic that with the right signals, and pricing is one of them, but there are others, we can grow more food with less water. We can continue to feed the planet and yet reduce the water impact, the water footprint of what we do.
And one piece that I'm not at all familiar with California's agriculture issues, but most of the rest of the world are subsistence farmers. And again, most familiar with East Africa, where it's over 90% in Rwanda are people that farm for their daily needs. And not only can we use less water, they're going to have to. With climate change, again, not really caused by developing countries, but they will suffer the consequences the most because of geography, because of where they happen to be, because of money. The infrastructure is not in place to deal with this. Even if the technologies exist, the infrastructure is not already there and the money is not there to do it. And because most of the water that's used, as Peter said, both here and everywhere else, is for agriculture. And water patterns are already changing. There's already less water. There's, in some rivers in Africa, some of the main rivers in Africa, there's 40% less water now than 10 years ago already.
Because of climate change.
Yeah. Well, yes, I think so.
Partly because of more use, because of changing weather patterns and climate patterns, but also greater use.
Greater demand.
Greater population. I would note diet is a factor here. It takes 16,000 tons of water to grow a ton of beef. It takes 1,000 tons of water to grow a ton of grain. So a meat diet is a water-intensive diet, and so that's a factor as well.
So we've got another question here. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Peter Madden. I run a non-profit called Forum for the Future based in London, New York. Just to quickly challenge that point, if it's a rain-fed agriculture, the rain falls from the sky, then it doesn't matter about the tonnage, I don't think, if it's naturally recycled. But anyway, we can come back to that argument. I want a different argument, which is about geopolitics. And if you look at the concentrations of people in the world and where the available potable water is, there's a huge imbalance, basically, between where lots of people are and where water availability are. So panel want to speculate about what that's going to mean for relationships between countries in the future as that plays out.
So, yeah, what about the possible conflicts of water? Have any of you seen that already in your work?
I've seen it I haven't seen it country to country, like country against another country, personally. I know it probably exists, but I just haven't seen it. But I've definitely seen it on a more communal or regional level where you're seeing back to that whole privatization, those people, those power players there that are really taking advantage of what we call basic fundamental human right. That's what I've seen. But
on the second point, one of the things we do at the Pacific Institute is we maintain a database of conflicts over water. So if you're interested in that in particular, if you go to worldwater.org or Google water conflict chronology, it's a database with hundreds of examples of conflict, going back thousands of years, of conflicts over water, either access to water or water used as a weapon or water used as a target. I mean, there are lots of examples. And in recent years, more and more of the examples are over access, over equity, over development, economic development and access to water. On the second point, I agree, irrigated agriculture, it's really important to improve the efficiency of it, but I would argue that rain-fed agriculture is important too. If you can grow more food with the same amount of rain through different kinds of cropping patterns or mulching or different kinds of agricultural practices, that's a big advantage too. So I would argue there's potential in both rain-fed and irrigated systems.
Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Lisa Chen, and I work at an interdisciplinary center on the UC Berkeley campus called Center for Effective Global Action, CEGA. We try to figure out what works and what doesn't in development. And my question is, you guys have said that technology, we know the technology, we know how to translate dirty water to clean water, but how do you know what's the appropriate technology in any given setting? How do you take into account the social and economic factors? How do you know that the life straw, while it works, I've seen it work, it's great, I drank from it, how do you know that that was the best technology for a community versus something like chlorination? And, you know, what does this speak to about the larger global community and what we use for our own water use? And maybe, what do you think about the ethical questions about maybe it's time for the global community to cut back on what we do? Thank you very much.
So there's a tension in development, and you just hit on it. The tension is you can have many, many hour-long conversations about community-specific tailoring, culturally appropriate of the technology and the project, and then in the next breath say we have to go to scale. And it's the exact same tension. Water for People struggles with it. We struggle with it. A lot of organizations struggle with it. You can customize an approach for a village, but then how are you ever going to reach more than one village or 100 villages? There's 15,000 villages in Rwanda alone. So in our particular sphere, we do a lot of pilots. We do a lot of stakeholder consultations and focus groups, essentially, to see what's appropriate on a regional or country level. And then, there's some people who don't like our life straw and they have it in their home and there might have been something better for them. But we have to strike a balance between the most discreet, appropriate solution and something that's actually going to solve this crisis in our lifetimes.
Jake or John, how have you guys managed that tension in your work?
I mean, I think the big thing is, you know, it's never going to be perfect. Like Evan said, some people aren't going to like the technology, it may not work, and there's going to be failures. So, I mean, first you have to admit that. You have to be monitoring it and paying attention enough to know, wow, that didn't work. Sorry, we'll do it again, figure out something better. But it all comes down to me to really having, not being the know-it-all from far away, coming in and saying, hey, we've got some of the tools, we can help, we've got some of the money, we can help, but we need you. We need to partner with your best engineers, your local universities, your municipalities, and the people on the ground who are dealing with it every day. What's going to work for them? And it may not work for everyone, but we're going to try and do the best. And that's, I mean, I think the key, the fundamental key to a successful, not perfect, but successful model is partnership and asking the right questions and not thinking that we know it all from our seat way back here, because we don't.
Just, I know you're going to jump in on that too. One, I just wanted to back up that statement. Something that Water for People does extremely well is partnerships and capacity buildings with national and regional and local governments, and it's critical. And there's this, it's changing now, but it used to be in development, the mantra was, developing countries are corrupt, they're going to take your money, they don't know what they're doing, and we should avoid them, and we should fly under the radar, and we're so great because we're able to do it without them. And that really didn't work. There is corruption out there, but the best way to do it is to find the people in the government who are good and who are working towards a common goal. Rwanda, where we work, 18 years ago, was the most failed country in the world, effectively. And now it's one of the safest, cleanest, fastest-growing economies, fastest reduction in child mortality in the entire world annually. And our program is directly integrated with their health program. They provide free health insurance to the poorest 30% of the country. There's no plastic bags allowed in the country. They have five community health workers in every village that work for the Ministry of Health. Our program is inside their program. So yes, we can be criticized for some pieces of what we do, but our defense is that we are integrated into the government initiatives that are proving to be relatively effective for most people in the country.
Do you ever get criticized for what you do, John?
All the time. Yeah, and specifically by myself. it's so much of it. I mean, Jake summed it up. You know, we're not experts. Doesn't matter how smart you are and how much research you've done. It's really just going to be about time on the ground and assessments and spending. Nothing replaces time spent. I've learned everything that I feel I have any knowledge about from spending time there. and working with these local communities and developing local networks so that these solutions can be integrated and implemented in at the highest, most maximum level. And that could be the local government. Finding that key player in the local government, it's hard in a lot of countries because it really is, in my opinion, been corrupt. Or it could be a medical director at the little local clinic or a school. Or it could just be, in Liberia, I had a 17-year-old kid come up to us and was so enthusiastic about what we were doing, and he was just one of those angels, you know? The guy who you could just tell really cared about his community. He was already helping his community, and all you're doing is empowering him by giving him new skill sets, new tools, new information, new education to go help his community further. That's your ringer. That's your player right there, and he's not an official, anything like that. But then we do, and then it's all about assessments. Whether it's doing assessment first to figure out what the solutions are, the water table is 400 feet deep right here. We're not going to do well, but we can check the rainfall. Maybe we'll do a rain catchment system, and then you're adjusting the solutions you want to allocate. But then you have these key local networks that will hopefully adopt that and empower their community themselves. You're trying to remove yourself out of the equation. So,
another question.
My name's Annie. I work for a company called Water Planet Engineering, and we do wastewater recycling systems for major industrial and municipal. But my question's actually about potable water and sanitation, which you guys have been talking about. And if there's a spectrum from, on the one end, like the straws and the kind of impermanent solutions, like the filters that you maybe use in disaster relief, and then on the other, there's major sunk network systems like we have here and rely on that are kind of out of reach in a lot of those communities. What are the middle ground solutions that are more permanent but that aren't so big and capital intensive to start?
There are community level interventions. So the ones we've been largely talking about are household scale water treatment or sanitation. And you're entirely right. It's an interim solution. That interval might be 10 or 20 years or more, but it's not, nobody who does household water treatment thinks it's the perfect solution long term. But it's on a relative scale. But there are community-level work that is done. There's community-level water treatment systems that can be maintained locally by moderately trained technicians, like ultraviolet disinfection or RO systems or some larger gravity-fed filtration systems. There's also community biogas systems that might take in human and animal waste and produce methane that can be used for cooking and also helps address the sanitation issues. So I could go on, but yes, there are sanitation and energy and water technologies that are on the 100 to 1,000 person range.
I would just caution you not to assume that small scale community systems can't be permanent and sustainable.
Absolutely.
That everybody ultimately has to head for a big centralized municipal kind of system that we, most of us, have grown up with. I don't think that's true. I think there are new technologies, existing technologies, that are smaller scale but distributed. Ironically, non-technical solutions like watershed protection that make sure that the water doesn't get contaminated in the first place is a part of a sustainable solution for any community that reduces the need for high-tech, high-energy solutions in the long run. So there are lots of things at lots of scales, and I think that's the good news.
Let's get another question in here.
Yeah, I have two questions. One, why do you think the U.S. has been so slow to adopt gray water systems for local recycling? And what do you think about companies like Nestle, Pepsi, and Coke pumping out aquifers and then selling the water for large profits?
Let's go the second one first, the easy one, and then we'll go to the other one.
Okay, so you think that's an easy one, but yeah. It's not so easy. Some people think, okay, bottled water is a commodity. If you're going to buy it, they're going to make it and sell it to you. Sorry. It's a debate. Bottled water is a big debate. And I wrote a whole book about it called Bottled and Sold, the story behind our obsession with bottled water. It's sort of a strange story. As long as there's demand for bottled water, which they're going to encourage with advertising and making you fear your tap water, as long as you're buying bottled water, and none of you are, I know, but a lot of people are, they're going to make it. And so then it's a question of education. It's a question of making sure that there's public drinking water fountains. It's a question of regulation to make sure that they're actually meeting requirements. It's a question of counter-advertising. More and more municipalities are beginning to advertise potable water, although they don't really have the budgets for it. This is a political debate more than anything else.
Any other views on this political debate?
Well, I do, just in terms of rainwater catchment. You know, we did this project in the Lakota Indian Reservation in South Dakota, which is a sovereign nation. We were able to go in there and get tribal approval and not have to follow the federal rules and regulations. I didn't realize, I hadn't done a lot of research in America, you know, because it seems so natural, you know, catching rainwater and using it. And there, it's state by state, but I think a lot of it, what I've learned, and I could definitely be wrong on this, I probably am, but I feel like it's an infrastructure, a political debate in terms of infrastructure, because we pay for infrastructure, and that's what makes us a developed country. You know, one of the things that makes us a developed country. So when you pay for that, if it's just free range and people are just going to go rogue, then they're going to not have that money to provide this great infrastructure. So, like, while we were on the reservation there doing these basic rain catchment systems, there was a man in Oregon that exact week that got arrested and put in jail for 30 days for doing the exact same thing. And they blame it, or said it was more about a question of sanitation, you know, because he was doing it for consumption and also using it for landscaping. And they're using that, but I personally, just my gut feeling is it's more about this political issue of infrastructure, you know, and kind of going off the grid and going rogue, and then it's all going to be chaos, which I don't necessarily disagree with. So I think there's a fine line there. I don't know.
I'm sorry, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to the other questions. I invite you guys to try to, buttonhole the panelists afterwards. As an informed tradition, we like to ask, and I'm going to throw the question to Jake, John, Evan, and Peter, in 60 seconds, so you really got to hit this one succinctly. What's the one thing that you would encourage people to do, your sort of one idea for changing the world in 60 seconds? Lightning round.
Who first?
We'll just go down the row. Jake?
60 seconds, all right. I would say find your passions in life, follow them, and then figure out a way to leverage your skills and your passions to make an impact in the world. You don't have to be digging the well yourself. Just figure out a way to leverage your skills to make an impact, because we can all do that. We can't all be on the front lines, but we can all leverage our skill set, leverage our passion, leverage our intellect to make the world a better place.
That was what I was going to say.
I stole your sheet.
Me too. Dang it.
All right, erase what I just
said. No, but this is one of my all-time, central values, is connecting your passion with purpose. And, my whole, I guess, for lack of better terms, tagline of what I base my whole organization around, the work we do, is go do what you love to do and help along the way. And so for me, that's my central principle. I believe that to live a truly vital existence, that is connecting those two things. We can go do our work and provide this support and these resources in these places, but we can also do it in a way that supports and feeds our passions. I like to climb mountains too. I like to go surfing. I like to do those things. And I go do those things. And then we help along the way, and we're having just the same amount of impact as if we just set up in a place and did the work. But when you connect those two things, this is longer than 60 seconds, sorry. When you connect those two things, I think that is when you get really in touch with your purpose and your path in life.
You said this far more eloquently than I did.
Evan?
I'll build on that a little bit. So, follow your passion and what you're good at, but also make sure you're doing it well. There's a lot of people out there that are do-gooders, that are following their passion, that might not actually be having the positive impact that they want to be having, both on an individual level and an organizational level. And I think the revolutionary idea that a lot of people are adopting now is performance-based financing for everything, not just being a business, but being a development agency. You only get paid if you actually do what you said you were going to do, not just for you don't get A for effort. You get paid and you get the A for actually effectively helping.
Peter, last word.
So these guys have been very eloquent, and I agree with them. Maybe yesterday I would have answered this question by saying go vote, but you've all done that. But go do something. So run for your local water board. Buy a front-loading washing machine and an efficient shower head and an efficient toilet. Give money to one of the many non-governmental organizations working in the field, or go volunteer for some of those organizations. It's what these guys have already said, but follow your passion. Do what you want, what you can. Our skills are all different. Our interests are all different. Our abilities are all different. But water is such a big topic because it touches on everything. There's something for everybody, and find out what it is and do something.
Fantastic, you guys. Let's give a big round of applause.